I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Nancy Hollander. She is a criminal defense attorney based in Albuquerque. She represents Guantanamo detainee Mohamedou Ould Slahi, who has just published a new book called Guantanamo Diary. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk first about Mohamedou's story. He was born in Mauritania in 1970. He got a scholarship to go to Germany and study electrical engineering. What happened then?
Well, he went to Germany. I should backtrack a little bit. He comes from a very poor family. Only two people received these scholarships that year. And he was the first one in his family to leave Mauritania, as far as we know. He went to Germany, and while he was in Germany in about 1990, that was the time when the Afghanis were fighting against the Soviets and the communist-backed government in Afghanistan. And he, along with many other young Muslim men, went to fight. The United States actually supported that effort with millions of dollars in guns and funds. Mohamedou went, and when the communist government fell in Kabul, he went back to Germany, and he never went back again to Afghanistan. He never fought with the later al-Qaeda, which that morphed into. He went back, studied in Germany, then moved to Montreal, and ultimately was back home in Mauritania when the United States captured him and basically disappeared him away from his family.
How did he become targeted as a terror suspect? I mean, there were a lot of people he talks about in his book fighting against communism as a religious freedom action on his own part. How did he become a terror suspect all those years later?
Well, one of the things that happened was that when he moved to Montreal, it was, I believe, just after a man named Ahmed Rassam left Montreal and was ultimately arrested coming into the United States at the other end of Canada, Victoria, with what was presumed to be the intent to blow up LAX airport. Rassam pled guilty and talked about a lot of people who were involved with him, but never about Mohamedou. Although everyone who prayed at the same mosque with Rassam in Montreal went under suspicion, including Mohamedou. At the same time, the government knew or discovered at that time that Mohamedou's cousin, a man named Abu Hafs al-Mauritani, was close to Osama bin Laden. So they had those two links, and that's why he originally came under suspicion. He was arrested three times in Mauritania. The third time, he was at his mother's house. He received a call from the police saying, "Would you come and talk to us?" He said, "Yes, of course," just like he had in the past. They told him, and he discusses all this in the book, "You'll be home, you know, in a day, you'll be home tonight or in a day or two." And he never was home again. The United States took him illegally to Jordan, where they tortured him and interrogated him for almost 8 months about the Millennium bombing, and then told the Americans he had nothing to do with it, send him home. But the U.S., instead of sending him home, sent him to Afghanistan and then to Guantanamo.
It's really worth noting that until he went to Guantanamo, everybody who interrogated him and tortured him and questioned him over and over and over again came to the conclusion that he had really nothing to do with any of this stuff.
That's correct. And it was only after he got to Guantanamo that they then decided that he was one of the people who had recruited the pilots for 9/11. And that was because he had briefly one night met with a man named Ramzi Ben al-Sheba, who is currently facing a military commission trial as one of the 9/11 defendants. But that meeting or visit was 2 years earlier. That was in 1999. And ultimately, by the time you get to 2010, where Mohamedou has a hearing on a habeas petition that we had filed for him, the government admits that he probably never knew anything about 9/11. So the government dropped the Millennium bombing charge, or allegation, dropped the allegation about 9/11. And that all happened in 2010. But Mohammadi has never, ever been charged with a crime the whole time he's been in Guantanamo.
So in Guantanamo, he was interrogated continually, asked the same questions hundreds and hundreds of times, which in itself doesn't constitute torture, but the way he describes it, it gets very annoying. The torture came later, but what were they asking about? I mean, the millennium about 9/11, what was the purpose?
Well, his interrogation, it's hard to know what the purpose was. His interrogation did rise to the level of torture. He was dragged out on a boat, beaten, terrified, led to believe that he would be executed, which is torture, led to believe that he would be rendered to a foreign country. In fact, they wanted him to believe when he came back from the boat ride that he was in another country. They beat him. They made him drink salt water. Later, there was sexual abuse of American female guards who unclothed themselves around him and touched him. They refused to let him pray. And this was all a list, a specific list of interrogation techniques that were signed by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld at this time when they had convinced themselves that he must be a very big deal. And on the other hand, it's not clear what they were after with him, because they said to him, and he talks about this, "We know what you did. We're convinced you did these things. We just want you to admit it." And ultimately, what made him start talking to them was something else they did, which is a clear violation of the Geneva Convention, which was to bring a fake letter. They said they had arrested his mother, and they were bringing her to Guantanamo. And how did he think she would fare there, implying that she would be raped when she was put in a prison with all these men? And at that point, he just said yes to whatever they asked him. And he talks about this in the book, and he gives one example. For example, they said to him, "We know you plan to blow up the tower in Toronto." And he responds in the book that he didn't even know there was a tower in Toronto. But his answer to the interrogators was, "Oh, yes, of course, and I was going to do it with these people." So they gave him, they fed him information, and he said yes to it. There was a Marine Colonel, Couch, Stuart Couch, who went to Guantanamo around that time to prosecute Mohammadi, and they were thinking at that time of trying to prosecute him on the death penalty charge for 9/11. And Colonel Couch discovered this torture and discovered that Mohammadi had not provided any information that the government didn't already know, and that the government had violated his rights, his protections under Geneva and under the Convention Against Torture, and he refused to prosecute him, which was really significant. And he said he wasn't going to have anything to do with that file. And, of course, nobody ever picked it up after that, because there is nothing. This really is an innocent man who should never have been taken to Guantanamo in the first place.
The torture that he experienced and the cruelty that he experienced were on so many levels. One of them was, I mean, not only the beatings and the sexual abuse and the sleep deprivation and the starvation and putting them in stress positions and playing horrible loud music in their ears and not letting him see the light of day ever, so it was hard to know what time of day it was, and removing people from the company of other inmates, which was a great solace to Mohammadi and to the others to even be able to talk to each other. But on top of that, it's a total catch-22 with all that torture, with the interrogation, with the non-torture interrogation where they're just asking you the same thing over and over and over again, day after day, year after year. If you're innocent and you tell the truth, they punish you for not telling them what they want to hear. And then if you tell them what they want to hear, they also punish you for not telling the truth.
That's correct. I mean, you can't win. And even though he started, quote, cooperating, the whole recipe, as he called it, of torture continued for months after that, until finally they just gave up and it ended. But in many ways, the torture continues to this day, because now we're 10 years later, or 12 years later, and he's still locked up in indefinite detention because he's never been charged with a crime. And the only neutral person who ever heard this case was Judge Robertson from the district court in Washington, D.C., because we brought a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, which just means it's not a criminal case. It just means I'm here illegally, let me out. I mean, that's all habeas corpus really means. And we had a hearing. Mahamudu testified from Guantanamo. The judge heard him testify. And he found that the government didn't have sufficient evidence to overcome this habeas petition and ordered him released. Now, all the government needed what we call in the law a preponderance of evidence. This is a very low standard. This is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case. They just need to tip the scales, and they couldn't even do that in 2010 after they'd already held him for 9 years. So the Obama administration had this plan that they were going to convince the Court of Appeals in Washington to loosen the standards of who is a part of al-Qaeda, because that's really all they had at that point, was that they claimed he was a part of al-Qaeda. And the Court of Appeals agreed with the government, loosened their evidentiary standards, and sent the case back for another hearing. And we've never had that other hearing.
So basically, he was ordered released from Guantanamo, and the Obama administration fought that release, and so 4 or 5 years later, he's still in Guantanamo.
That's correct. That's correct. So if the Obama administration is really serious about closing Guantanamo, they can stop fighting this habeas case and the others. And in fact, we have a petition up at the ACLU's website that asks people to write to the Secretary of Defense and ask them to stop fighting this habeas petition, in which case Mahamudu could be released. The other thing the government is doing now are these periodic review boards, and we are asking that Mahamudu be scheduled for one quickly, and so that he can be found to not be a threat, which he will be found, and released that way. And if we could have another habeas hearing, we would like to have that. We're fully convinced that the judge would come to the same conclusion that he did before.
We're talking to attorney Nancy Hollander about Guantanamo detainee Mahamudu Oldslahi. It seems like there's something crazy going on in addition to the disgrace of being a country that tortures and violates its own constitution by holding people without trial. And that is that they extract through torture false confessions in which the person being tortured will then implicate other people just to make the pain stop. And then they'll use that information, that false information, to interrogate the next falsely accused person until they have a totally fabricated narrative that passes as an intelligence breakthrough. And meanwhile, they're not getting any closer to the truth of the situation of actual terrorism.
Well, that's all true, and the government and the courts now tend to believe raw intelligence and give it the presumption of reliability, which is just outrageous. So it's very difficult for a prisoner in Guantanamo to win a habeas case or to really win anything. The review boards are supposed to just focus on whether the person is currently a threat and not what happened in the past. And the one thing that is good about them is that they absolutely don't rely on any coerced testimony. So if that's true in Mahamudu's case, they have nothing. And they had nothing to begin with, but they have even less than nothing now. And he really is an innocent person who should never have been there.
What agencies within the U.S. government were doing the interrogation and the torture, and how did they work together or not work together?
Well, we don't know all the agencies that were doing the interrogation. We know that he started out with the FBI, and they were doing it the way they normally do things, with rapport building, and then they didn't torture him, and then they turned him over to the military. There's actually an FBI Inspector General's report that came out in 2008 that describes that some of the people in the military were pretending to be FBI agents so the FBI would get into trouble. But I don't know what all the agencies were that were interrogating him.
Do you think that the people who were involved with these essentially crimes against Mohamedou and other Guantanamo detainees, crimes against, I don't know if it qualifies as crimes against humanity, war crimes, will or could ever be brought to justice in our country?
The Convention Against Torture, which is a treaty that the United States has signed, requires countries that sign it to prosecute those who commit torture and cruel, inhumane treatment. We have not done that. It also requires that the people who have been the victims receive damages. We haven't done that. We should. We should do both.
There was, as Mohamedou writes, a kind of U.S. checklist for terrorists. Young, Muslim, male, studied things like electrical engineering, well-traveled. And you look at this checklist and you think, this is crazy. It applies to thousands and thousands of people, and none of these things is even remotely a crime. Was it really that primitive, and is it still a formula for presuming guilt?
It is a formula for presuming guilt. These people are, we have to remember, Guantanamo is a wholly illegal event. It is a prison of foreigners, which of course makes it illegal. And it's a prison where we are now holding people, 122, and 50 plus of them were cleared by our people, cleared for release years ago. That means that probably upwards of six different intelligence agencies had to unanimously agree that this person was not a threat. And yet they're still there. And we don't allow them to come to the United States. We've put such severe restrictions on other countries that many of them have been unwilling to take them. We saw this play out in Uruguay, where it took a year for them to take the five prisoners because the government, the U.S. government, kept putting such strict requirements on them. Finally, we gave up on those requirements and they went to Uruguay, where they were welcomed and their families were welcomed. But the U.S. government has made it difficult in every way. It's a wholly illegal system. It shouldn't have started, and that illegality continues. The government also makes it very difficult for people to represent their clients in Guantanamo. It's difficult and expensive to get there. Everything they say is presumed to be classified, so everything the client writes comes back to a secure facility. I live in New Mexico. We have to have a lawyer in Washington to go read the letter. Then we can't talk about it on the phone. And, you know, it just continues, and it continues a regime of secrecy that the government has promoted. It took us 6 years to get this book released, which is another example of how hard the government has fought.
Let's talk about that. In 2005, Mohamedou, I guess they allowed him to have enough paper and pens to handwrite this book, which is over 350 pages long. How did that come to happen?
Well, the book started the first day we met Mohamedou. I went there with another lawyer who was on the team at that time, Sylvia Royce, and our first visit was in 2005. And that's when we first heard about him, agreed to represent him. And we walked in to the hut that the military was using for counsel interviews. And we walked in, and Mohamedou stood up. And it's a moment I'll never forget, because he stood up, and he smiled at us and reached his arms out. And, you know, we kind of waited for him to come to us and then realized that he couldn't, because he was shackled to the ground, shackled to the floor. And so we had to walk into his embrace. And we spent 2 days with him, during which time he gave us the first 90 pages of what became this book. And he originally gave it to us so that we would know something about him, something about his life and his history and what had happened to him at that time. And then over the course of the year, he continued writing and sending us the book in small pieces. And after we had it all, we and he decided that we wanted to release it, and that's when the fight started with us and the government that went on for 6 years.
And they didn't want it released just because it would make them look bad.
Well, you have to ask them what their intent was. They told us that the only way we would get it released would be to give up the privilege that he had of it being an attorney-client privilege document. So, in other words, we could have it and decide what parts of it we wanted to release. And we eventually had to give that up, or he had to give it up. It's his privilege. And he had to give that up and send the whole thing to the government, to whatever agencies they sent it to. And that once we made the decision, took another 2 or 3 years before it came back, ultimately in a cleared version.
It's worth noting that English is Mohamedou's fourth language, and he learned it in Guantanamo from guards, from the people he met there. He became remarkably fluent. I mean, it's a very well-written book, including fluent in kind of military and colloquialisms and swear words and things like that, but he has such a kind of beautiful English. The book is full of redactions, so what we see as black bars on the page, a lot of the things that are taken out are kind of transparent. So, for example, whenever a female guard or interrogator is mentioned, not only is her name blacked out, but the pronouns, she and her, are also removed. So it's so weird because they do these redaction, then it becomes more obvious what gender each person in the narrative is. Could you talk a little bit about the redactions?
Well, I can't talk about the redactions. I can tell you the government made its decisions about what it redacted, and we received the document in that form, and that's the form in which it's cleared. I can't speak to the redactions at all. Okay. You'd have to ask the government.
After the period of torture, there was a period of relative peace in which Mohamedou's guards and captors were basically ordered to be nice to him. Was that part of an interrogation strategy?
Again, you'd have to ask the government. I think they finally just gave up. And we know that in 2007, the chief prosecutor at the time, Colonel Morris Davis, had a meeting with the Department of Defense, the Department of Justice, the CIA, the FBI, and they all said, look, we don't have anything on this guy. Colonel Davis thinks that they realized that they really owe him for how badly they treated him, and so they started treating him well.
We're talking to attorney Nancy Hollander about the book Guantanamo Diary, written by her client Mohamedou Ould Slahi. Over the course of reading this book, which I hope everybody reads, I think it's a really important book for Americans to read at this time in our history when 9/11 is a little bit more remote and when we are looking at the current situation of fear and the kind of encouraging of fear on the part of government and sometimes media. But over the course of reading this book, I came to have a really deep admiration and affection for Mohamedou Ould Slahi. He has an intelligence and wisdom and fairness and resilience that I think are extraordinary. Throughout the book, there's these little kind of kernels of wisdom. Like he says, if there's anything at all good in war, it's that it brings out the best and the worst in people. Some people try to use lawlessness to hurt others, and some to try to reduce the suffering to a minimum. And I found that he was remarkably fair and honest toward the people who had total power over him.
He was, and that is who he is. He is a very forgiving person. He understands that every person has some good and evil in them. He treats everyone as an individual, unlike what we have done as a country, where we have lumped people together in the worst possible ways and in ways that we should have learned from history one shouldn't do. Mohamedou never does that. Every individual is an individual. If that individual is mean to him, he recognizes that. If that individual is good to him, he recognizes that. And even after all this time, if you read the note from the author at the end of the book, the very end of the book, that was written just 6 months ago when he said he would like to sit down and have a cup of tea with these people, that they've learned so much from each other. And he also talks in the book, and it's really brings out his personality. He's kind of a funny guy. He makes a lot of jokes. And at one point, he says in the book that, you know, you can't choose your family. And he didn't choose this to be his family, but these guards and interrogators have become his family. And whether he likes them or not, there's some that are good and some that are bad. And that is who he is. He's very thoughtful. He's inquisitive and curious, and so he learns about people. But he holds no grudges. He just wants to go home.
And for him, like for many Guantanamo detainees, the greatest tragedy of all is not seeing one's family, not seeing one's children grow up. He will never see his mother again. His mother passed while he was in detention. And those are things that, I mean, even if he were to be released, all the reparations in the world can't make up for.
Well, and you're right. And, you know, they also used the fact that they learned early on somehow that he was very close to his mother. So that they did two things. One is they gave him this fake letter saying that they were going to bring her to Guantanamo. There was also another time that he talks about in the book where they brought him a letter that they said was from his mother, and it wasn't. And then there's another time in the book where he finally received a letter from his mother, and he talks about how he smelled it because he was hoping it would have the smell of his mother, and how happy he was to hold in his hand something that she had held. And then the tragedy of the fact that she died, and we had to tell him, Terry Duncan, my co-counsel on this case, who's also been involved in it since 2005, we had to ask for a special telephone call because you don't get them unless they're emergencies. And she had to tell him on the phone that his mother had died, which was probably one of the hardest things to do. And, of course, he will never see his mother again. And that's one of the real tragedies of this case.
What has been the response in his native country of Mauritania to his detention?
The Mauritanians appear to be very favorable to his return. There have been demonstrations in Mauritania. The officials who, Terry Duncan actually was in Mauritania last year with our investigator, Chris Chung, and the officials she met with certainly gave her every reason to believe that they would be supportive of his returning home. This is not the same government that illegally turned him over to the United States. That government, you know, there have been a few coups in Mauritania since that time. And this is a very different government. And they would support his coming back. So he can go home. The only impediment is the government of the United States.
Reading this book, I felt shame and anger toward my own country. And if I feel this way, I can only imagine how men and women in the Muslim world feel about his story and others like it. Do you have any comment about the response and possibly blowback caused by the ongoing situation in Guantanamo?
Well, I believe that President Obama said that Guantanamo is harming our national security. And of course, it does harm our national security. How can it not? How can anyone in the Muslim countries look at this and think that this is a fair country, that we are fair to them? We're not. We lump people together in the worst ways. And Americans do that because I hear it all the time. They're Arabs, so they're bad. Not even understanding that not all Arabs are Muslim or that all Muslims are Arab. I mean, because there's so little understanding. You know, this country is uniquely ignorant, I have discovered, and it's a bit frightening. And an example is, I was in Europe recently working with Amnesty International and about this case and another case that I have. And I would mention that Mohamedou came from Mauritania, which is a country in North Africa or West Africa. And they stopped me and said, why do you keep telling us where it is? We know where it is. But when I speak in the United States, nobody knows where it is. And it's because we've managed to be ignorant, and we've let our leaders let us be ignorant, and people just go with that ignorance. I find many people who tell me when I meet them that they believe Guantanamo was closed, or they believe everyone there is a terrorist, or they don't believe me when I say there are people there, many people there, over 100 people there now, who've never been charged with a crime. It just mystifies people, and it partly mystifies people because we have this ignorance in this country and this belief that we're the greatest country in the world and have the greatest justice system in the world. We do have a good justice system when we use it, but we're not using it on a large number of people.
And that's one of the things that Mohamedou comments on in this book, Guantanamo Diary. He talks about how when he was transferred to Guantanamo, he said, well, at least I'm in the hands of Americans. They have due process, so I should be out of here pretty quickly. And then the very kind of ignorance that you're talking about right now, he sees that in the people who are interrogating him, the people who have power over him, and he sees it very clearly for what it is, and he has a kind of objective understanding. He says things like, well, yes, this man joined the army. I understand that some of the poorest and most challenged Americans do that, so it's no surprise to me that these people are ignorant and having problems. It's just amazing.
Well, he has tremendous perception. You know, he talks to a guard who wouldn't let him pray, and that was one of the things that was specific that Rumsfeld required. These people are not allowed to pray, which, of course, again, is illegal. But he talks about this one guard who says, and he says, why won't you let me pray? You know that's illegal. And the guard says to him, yes, I do know that, but if I don't do what I'm told to do, what I'm instructed to do, I'll get some, you know, bad job because I have no clout here, and yet I know I'm probably going to hell for what I've done. And Mohamedou picks up on that, and he understands the situation that this man is in. And I find that empathy from him, even after what he's been through, to be just amazing. Yet he maintains that because he sees everyone as an individual and understands their circumstances.
And he's able to find comfort in small things, like even a little bit of human contact during a transport or a moment of warmth in the Cuban sun when they're keeping him in a very cold room, or when they finally gave up on him and ordered the guards to be nice to him. He started playing chess, and there was a kind of, like, he realized very quickly as soon as he learned to play chess that he could beat people, and there was a kind of empowerment in knowing that in that little domain you had some control. But through all of that and through all of the cruel treatment that he experienced, his health was very poor. Very few people could withstand and stay healthy through the kind of torture that he experienced. What is his health like now? And what was the role of doctors through his torture? What is their role now, and what is his health like now?
Well, he describes, probably not a doctor, but a corpsman who treated him after he got off the boat and was so mean to him. And he describes it in great detail in the book, how this guy comes to wrap his ribs after they've broken his ribs and, you know, says, you better not spit on me. You better not bite me. I mean, it says just horrible things and is masked. And Mohamedou doesn't understand, is this really a medical person or not? Later, when they realize how damaged he is, they start giving him antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications. They've treated his illnesses that he's had. I think now, physically, he's pretty healthy. Psychologically, he's reasonably healthy. He's clearly a fragile and damaged person. You just don't get over that kind of torture, especially since he's still in the same place where he was tortured. But the medical care there now is much better than it was. The food is better. He now gets to eat on a regular basis when he's supposed to eat. Food isn't withheld. And so in that sense, I think he's reasonably okay. But every day, as he describes it 10 years ago, is still the same. Every day is Groundhog Day. Every day is the same. He's in a prison. He's in indefinite detention, and nothing changes from day to day.
What have been the responses to this book so far, and what are your hopes for the book?
Well, the response to the book has been incredible, just incredible. It's now on the New York Times bestseller list. It's going to be on the front page of the New York Times magazine section. There's been press all over the world. The book is sold all over the world. The Guardian has a dedicated website, GuantanamoDiary.com, with readers from very famous people reading the book and portions of the book. So the response to the book has been overwhelming and overwhelmingly good. The first thing we want is for Mahamudu to be released. That's the most important thing. The second thing is for people to understand and learn more about Guantanamo, about who we are and what we've done. And what Mahamudu describes has been described by the government, because these torture, and they don't ever call it torture, but the interrogation techniques have been delineated in various reports from Congress and from the Justice Department. What we're learning in this book is to see it from the eyes of someone who's the victim, and to hear it from him, and to really sense it, smell it, taste it as he experienced it. That's what this book is about, and to understand a human being who we've locked up and who maintains his humor, maintains his dignity, maintains his empathy. So I hope everyone will read this book and learn from it, and I hope everyone will help us put pressure on the government to release Mahamudu and to release the others and to close Guantanamo. That's our goal.
Nancy Hollander is a criminal defense attorney. She represents Guantanamo detainee Mahamudu Oldslahi, who has just published a new book, Guantanamo Diary. It's published by Little Brown and has really just come out. The editor is Larry Seams. I want to thank you, Nancy, very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.